Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 32. We've been here for 32 weeks, and just to note, 32 is the atomic number, which is pretty dope. My name is David Brook. I am your co-host. I am here with Forrest Hollingsworth. He is also a co-host. That makes us combined super host. Am I right? Am I right?
By our powers combined.
We're like what are those twins?
The Wonder Twins?
That's it.
Yeah.
So this is the show where we talk about comic book news. We talk about the best books from last week, in our opinion, and have some fun segments set up for you every single week. Every single week. And at the top of every show, we talk about the news because that's really why a lot of you are here. Come on. Be honest. You want to know what's going on in the comic book industry.
Call 1-800-AIPG Comics Podcast and let us know.
There you go. I like it. 555-1800.
6969.
It wasn't a really big week of news, to be honest. There wasn't any controversy, really. But there were some notable things to talk about. Top of the list, I think, is the fact that Wildcats, the much-anticipated Wildcats, written by Warren Ellis with art by Ramon Villalobos, it came out that the book would not be coming out because of the solicitations. Or was it the sales?
DC decided to cancel the first orders of all three issues,
right.
And then they took it off the publishing schedule.
Usually a bad sign, but luckily Jim Lee and Ramon came out and said, no, don't worry, we just need more time.
Yeah.
We really are going to be doing this, and I think they also said Warren Ellis' scripts are da bomb.
Yeah.
They didn't say that specifically, but you know what I mean.
Villalobos said not canceled, just some deadlines missed, gonna stay grinding, right. The marathon continues. And Jim Lee also tweeted something out, which I think shows a high level of investment from the publisher,
true.
Right?
Yeah.
No one is more bummed than me to hear of the postponing of the launch of Warren Ellis's Wildcats. He made a point that Ellis had turned in numerous scripts and that they were just fantastic. And then he put in parentheses, trust me on this, which is like, all right, man.
That's funny.
And then in Ellis's newsletter, which I get to my Gmail, it's a great newsletter. Ellis said that he had completed a number of scripts as well as a whole outline document. It seems like quite a bit of it is done.
I am very excited to have this Ellis Ramon collaboration. I think it's going to be wild. Ramon, I mean, the work he did on Borderlands was out of this world, the monsters and stuff.
Yeah.
And to do a Wildcats book, I mean, the level of detail he puts into the boots on the characters is just wild.
Yeah, yeah. He reminds me a lot of Frank Quietly. Obviously.
Yeah.
But yep. I've been rereading Morrison's X-Men run and just kind of reveling in how much I actually like that attention to detail and that, sometimes the characters look like they need some lotion or whatever. You can see every individual pore. But,
right.
But like, that takes time and that takes craft and dedication and to make
for sure.
It look good on the page. I think the only other artist that comes even close is Villalobos, so.
For sure.
It feels fair to me.
In other news, Michael Fife has, or Image and Michael Fife have come out and said that Capra is coming back at Image Comics in October. I don't know if you've ever read Capra, Forrest, but I was actually buying it when he was releasing it from like his personal store. And you could tell that it was like hand stapled.
That's cool. That's cool.
This was years and years ago, but like his style is very unique. It has like an old school look and feel to it. I'm really excited for this because his 31 issue run actually ended on a cliffhanger. So it's cool to see that it's coming back. Michael Fife is a really outspoken guy on social media and stuff. I recommend checking him out. He's just a lover of comics, and you can tell from Capra and from his art style that he brings like so much love to it. So I don't know. I'm excited to read it, and especially since it's like actually being published full time by a publisher now too.
I have not read any of Capra. I've read some of the other stuff he did. Like he did some G.I. Joe books,
yeah.
And some other things. Like he's definitely like a cartoonist by trade. Which reminds me of Ed Piskor and Tom Scioli. I'm happy to see that Capra is coming back, but I would also love if Michael found some time to do like a grand design Spider-Man or something like that.
Oh, yeah. That'd be dope. Yeah. Yeah. I imagine eventually he'll finish Capra, like he'll finish the story and move on from there. Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. And I think, you know, any story that you have that much investment in as a writer and an artist, and obviously, like you're saying, even self-publishing, like literally stapling the pages together, right? Like, mm-hmm. You should have the platform to put that story out and share it with the world if you're that driven by it. And I'm really inspired by artists that are that driven by it. But also, mm-hmm. dude, get that Marvel money.
Get that money. So speaking of money, I don't know if you know, but Buffy the Vampire Slayer is like a really popular series.
It makes money.
Well, Boom has come out and said that they're putting out a legacy edition to collect out-of-print stories. Now, here's the cool part. They are going to be reprinting every story in chronological order from the Buffy series, comic series.
Yeah, that's so cool.
So if you missed them, you're going to be able to get it all in chronological order, which is cool because, I mean, other publishers have published the series. There's been obviously a lot of miniseries here and there, disparate series. So it'll be neat to see it all kind of coming out in the right order. And this is starting next year in April. And I imagine Joss Whedon's probably involved in some form.
Maybe. I mean, I think he wrote the follow-up season comics. So he's going to get top billing as obviously like a writer and a creator. But mm-hmm. I don't know that. Did they say they're putting any new content in it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so that's cool.
I mean, he might write a foreword or two, I'm sure.
I think that also shows a lot of faith in the creators that are releasing the current Buffy the Vampire Slayer stories. Jordi Belair's Buffy book is really, really good. And they just launched mm-hmm. Angel, which is also really good. It reminds me a lot of when Marvel did this with Conan, or is still doing this with Conan. Like, they had a lot of faith in the story that Jason Aaron wanted to tell, and so they started releasing all of the previous Marvel books, as well as the Dark Horse books.
Right.
And it's like, you build up a brand, obviously because it costs you money, and it's a big brand that you have to pay licensing rights for and stuff, but also because you have faith in it. And I'm glad to see that as Buffy and Angel and stuff continue under them, that they're willing to kind of put their brand on everything Buffy before that.
It's kind of amazing this brand, Buffy, is still going strong without the show for so long now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's also interesting. Trending now we could do a Trending Now segment on this, like reprinting old stuff. Like you just said, Conan and now Buffy.
Yeah.
The old is new again.
All those Marvel's Decades books. There's lots of stuff like that happening right now. And I'm happy to see it. I love Buffy. I love the comic stories. I think they're just as good, if not better, than some of the last seasons of Buffy. So I'm happy to see it.
I suppose it's a nostalgia thing. Like, the ideal audience is in their mid to late 30s, probably.
Yeah.
And those are the people that grew up with these things.
Yeah. And I have no idea, like, maybe some of those Buffy, the out-of-print stories are, like, really expensive on the secondhand market.
Sure.
You know, like, when Neon Genesis Evangelion came out on Netflix, those DVDs were like $600.
Right.
So that could be part of it.
You know what will probably be $600 in about 5 years? Powers of X number one, a mint condition, CGC graded, and signed by Jonathan Hickman.
Yeah.
So we talked briefly last week about Hickman's revolutionary new take on X-Men. Well, Powers of X number one came out, and do you want to tell the people about this revelation in the issue?
Yeah, so I don't want to spoil too much, but there's Powers of 10 is built around the idea that we're going to see the X-Men in the past, we're going to see the X-Men now, we're going to see them in 100 years, and then we're going to see them in 1,000 years, which picks up off the Powers of 10 name really well, obviously, exponential growth and all that. But there's something indicated in this first issue, Powers of 10 number one, where Moira MacTaggert and Charles Xavier are talking, and then it cuts to a timeline that shows like the X-Men now, the X-Men in 10 years, and it's House of X number one is the picture for the X-Men in 10 years, which would imply, by any logical standard, that every X-Men story since that started releasing in, 1963 has taken place in 10 years in their lives.
That's mind-boggling.
I mean, what?
Could you imagine going through all those adventures in 10 years?
I mean, what? Yeah.
You need a really good therapist.
I mean, you really, like, on a microcosm, those people have died and come back, like, so many times in 10 years.
Oh, my God, you're right.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Wait, on top of that, isn't Kitty only, like, 14 or something?
Right. So that would make her, what, like, 24? Yeah.
I guess.
But she, what they're saying is, like, in 10 years, Kitty was introduced as a teenager, and then went all the way up to, like, almost marrying Colossus.
Yeah.
And stuff in like a 10-year frame, which I guess that's the normal path of some people's lives, but it's not the normal path of people's lives when they're also being taken to the age of apocalypse and like
it makes you wonder
the Phoenix Force and shit.
It makes you wonder does this mean then that like Spider-Man, Avengers, all these other series, it's only been 10 years?
Well, that's kind of where I wanted to go with this. Like,
yeah.
It would imply so, right? And I would say, like, the amount of faith that people have in the Hickman story, like, they're literally saying Hickman has set up a plan that outlines the X-Men stories for the next 30 years,
mm-hmm.
the next 30 publishing years. It would imply that they have a lot of faith in him as kind of a quasi-editor slash writer, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I guess. I don't know. Cyclops went from young lad to Hitler in 10 years. That's crazy.
That's true. He tried to kill all the Inhumans. Yeah, and,
right.
He created an... What was that team he made? The Execution Squad or whatever?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's wild.
I mean, also, I obviously don't think that this is true or true by any reasonable metric because, like, time is wibbly-wobbly and comics publications treat time is especially wibbly-wobbly. But then you also have, like, the history of the Marvel Universe with Mark Waid and Javier Rodriguez coming out right now, where Galactus is establishing this huge, monumental, multi-century timeline with the introduction of the first mutants all the way up to the X-Men and stuff like that. And that's definitely not taking place over 10 years. So I would defer to that one, the one that they're publishing under the, like, this is the concrete history of our universe.
Right.
Rather than a book that is ancillary to that, I guess.
It'll be interesting if that series kind of confirms this 10-year thing.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I have no idea. If they're in cahoots together, that's wild. But exciting. It's exciting and weird. And, you know, it really throws certain storylines and stuff into an interesting, dramatic pressure point.
Yeah, as a fan, it's fun to find out these new rules, but at the same time, it does box things in sometimes and could potentially sour the subject as well.
Right, absolutely.
Speaking of time, there's a Black Widow movie coming out next year, and wait a minute, spoiler alert, Black Widow's dead, so is this a prequel, or is she in some other dimension? What's going on here? This is a bit of news that we're talking about because the screenwriter has come out and said that comic book canon, wait, sorry, they will that she will skip comic book canon that's discriminatory. And this is literally what she said. I'm not interested in adhering to comic canon that is discriminatory in any way or that violates my values system. It's gotten people angry. Whenever you talk about comic book canon changing in a movie format, it annoys people. I don't understand why, though, because personally, I think this is great.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think so, too.
We should erase the mistakes of writers, especially if they were writing these stories at a time that's far different than where we are now. We're progressing every decade in social ways, right? So why would we adhere to something that was written 50 years ago?
Right. Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. And I appreciate that what she's saying is I'm skipping over the canon that I don't think meets out to our current year or our current media expectations well, rather than something like the upcoming Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie, where they're just saying this is completely ignoring comics and has it's nothing here is for comics fans or whatever the director of that said, which makes no sense to me.
That's a good distinction. Yeah,
to be more careful and kind of come in with an X-Acto knife and be like, ooh, that Russophobia hasn't aged well, or this right. really sexist story hasn't aged well. I mean, my favorite character in all of comics probably is X-23. And if you look at those NYX stories, oh my god, she's like a child prostitute. Like,
oh, that's right,
sucks. I don't ever want to see that in a fucking movie. Yeah, get it out of here. Get rid of it. Get it out of here.
There will be a purist out there, though, who liked that and is annoyed that it's not integrated into the film.
Yeah,
right?
But,
I mean, just bound to happen.
Yeah, probably men.
Probably, yeah.
Because it,
angry young men.
Right, so I'm very happy to see that someone who identifies as female is writing a movie that is a lot of people have been asking for a female-fronted Avengers movie. Obviously, Captain Marvel came out, but I wouldn't really include that with this. I'm glad to see that someone is going back in history through the comics with their own experience, the kind of experience that I want to see reflected on the screen, and being careful and conscientious and intentional about what they're doing and what they're telling.
I forgot to say her name is Jacque Schaefer, and this movie comes out May 1st, 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now everyone's going to be watching it with a scalpel and going, oh,
absolutely,
what did they ruin? Right.
And some people like celebrate that. I think it sounds like you and I are going to celebrate that and be like, fuck yeah, get it out of here, that shit sucks, right?
Right.
But other people are absolutely going to be tearing it down because of that, and I just don't find that a valid criticism at all.
No, things need to change.
Yeah,
the world is always changing.
Absolutely. And to answer your previous kind of lead-in, it is a sequel to Civil War.
Is it?
Yep.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah.
So it's a prequel, but not. It's still like. Yeah.
It's like the first time that they've really slotted a movie into this timeline in that way. I don't know if it'll track or not, but that's definitely not because they're cutting the discriminatory stuff. It's because that's a weird place to put a movie.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. Yeah, this is a comic podcast, not a movie podcast, but it makes you wonder. Each one of these films is leading to the next film, right? In some way, shape, or form.
Right.
And it makes me wonder, like, is there some secret thing that happened after Civil War with Black Widow that will affect change in the next couple movies? We'll see.
Yeah.
Maybe she interacts with Loki or something.
Yeah.
Did he get unstuck from time or
you
something?
You know, I hope that it recontextualizes everything that we saw from her before and also helps lead into Endgame. But that's a challenge to write to.
Yeah, it is. Now, that's a boxed-in sort of timeline, too, right?
Right.
In our last bit of news, Connecticut's biggest Comic-Con is starting next week, August 9th through the 11th. It's called Terrific-Con, and our very own Chris Hassan is going to be there reporting, getting the scoops, taking the pictures, etc.
taking pictures of scoops.
There you go. Yeah, there could be some ice cream in there. I don't know. He will be getting X-Men Monday together from that con. We don't know exactly who he'll be interviewing, but much like when I was at San Diego Comic-Con and I was interviewing folks on the floor for X-Men Monday, he will be doing the same. So hopefully he gets to talk to some big names and gives us a little more insight into the X-Men mythos.
Yeah. I will not be there. I live a long ways away from Connecticut.
You do. I mean, you could, if you start driving now, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm excited for this con. I know it's a smaller con, but if you actually look it up, Terrific-Con 2019, there are a ton of creators there, like a ton. A lot of them that don't go to New York Comic Con or San Diego Comic Con. So there's some room for scoops.
Yeah, right. Like there's actually time to talk to creators rather than be like book, sign.
Now I know like the X-Men Monday fan base is looking more for the Hickman spoilers, but
they're not too bad. Fuck yeah, Hickman.
Oh wow, look at that hot take. I hope you didn't pick one of his books in the top books of last week segment, which is about to start. Yeah. This is the segment where we talk about our favorite books that came out last week. We pick two, our top two, and we also talk a little bit about Comic Book Roundup and their top critic and top fan pick. And this week, the top critic pick was Sabrina the Teenage Witch number 4. Bum, bum, bum. And Kate Sanchez from But Why Though, I love that website name, said, with Sabrina the Teenage Witch number 4, Thompson writes a true teenage identity story while the artists Veronica and Andy Fish offer up a beautiful world to jump into, one of spooky fantasy and vibrant spells. Now that sounds like a book I want to read.
I didn't know that they were the artists on that. I want to check it out.
Yeah, it's been really solid. Our very own Nate, he's been reviewing it, and he's really loved it. It's a tight book.
Evan Dorkin is one of my favorite comics writers, and he wrote a trade series called Blackwood last year.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. they were the artists on that, and it was really, really fantastic. And it was a good mix of, like, authentic, earnest, fun teenage storytelling mixed with, like, straight up and down horror and magic.
Mm.
And I think that if they're working on a Sabrina story, that's really exciting to me because they can handle that balance really well.
For sure. Yeah, it's a good combo. I wonder if the audience is mostly teenagers.
I don't know. The same with Buffy, right? Does it come around to that? I don't know.
And then the top fan pick was Batman Last Night on Earth, number 2. It had 22 reviews. And I'm going to pull a person named Nihilist, who wrote, Snyder continues to delve deep into the dystopian, deconstructed world he's created for the series. And as with number 1, this issue is trippy as well. It's by far one of the best Elseworld tales we've seen in years. Wow. But also one that's confusing as hell. I pulled that quote because, I mean, I think that kind of hits the nail on the head. We both read this issue,
yes.
And it's so big. There's some crazy ideas at work, but it also doesn't totally make sense.
Nope. I don't want to be overly negative about a book that a lot of people loved, so I'm just going to say... It sounds like Nihilist needs to change his or her username. Not a nihilistic review, Nihilist.
No. Anywho, so what? I mean, those are the critic and fan picks on Comic Book Roundup, but what is your number 2 pick for us?
My number 2 pick this week is Manor Black, number 1 from Dark Horse Comics. This is written by Colin Bunn and Brian Hurt, and the important part to me is that the artist is Tyler Crook, who is one of my most favorite comic books artists working today. Actually, if you want to see some of his work, you could check out Harrow County, written by Colin Bunn, which I think is one of the best indie horror books of all time. I think that Manor Black, number 1, is this really interesting story about a family who has some sort of... It's very hard to tell right now what they're involved in. It's dark magics. It's like some sort of blood disease or ritual that they're passing down before they like ascend to a council for their own family. Kind of balance out with this story that's of a girl on the run from demons and different things happening, like a crazy car accident, and the police are investigating it, and the grass all around the car is burnt in a perfect black circle, and there's this weird, almost mummy-esque man that is committing crimes around the town. So they've introduced like a lot of elements, and I will say that I don't really think that the narrative made a lot of sense to me, or it was like really predicated on one cliffhanger, but Tyler Crook's art is amazing, and I am so happy to see that they are working together again, because Tyler's art is watercolor-esque. It's very painterly. It would lend itself to brighter storytelling, more hopeful storytelling, a lot easier than it does for horror. But to see a story that just like completely flips that and makes like these watercolor pastiches and vignettes and stuff the same way that it was in Harrow County really gross and scary is really, really exciting to me. It's a little bit Mignola-esque, but it's got enough of its own vibe and aesthetic that it really excites me a lot.
Nice. Do you know if it's going to be super long like Harrow County?
I think that it's only solicited right now for 6 issues, so it may be a mini-series.
Interesting.
Harrow County is really, really great, and I think that the story sustained itself over multiple issues. It's got 3 library editions from Dark Horse really well, so I could see this expanding into that, or them even doing a sequel or spinoff series. But Colin is kind of stretching himself thin right now with a lot of different books, so maybe he just doesn't have the time for it.
He's really good at that.
Yeah, true.
He always seems to be writing like 7 books at once. So like he has a couple, 1 or 2 titles at Aftershock as well.
Yeah. So lots going on for them. And I'm excited that they found the time to work together again.
Yeah, for sure. Everyone's been anticipating that, I think.
Yep.
My number 2 pick is Red Sonja, Lord of Fools. It's a one-shot from Dynamite Entertainment. It's written by Mark Russell with art by Bob Q and Katie O'Meara. This is great story within a story within a story within a story. There are actually 5 stories in this one story, which is really cool. It's set sort of like when there's kings and queens and whatnot. Obviously, Red Sonja is sort of in that realm anyway. She's not really in this issue, though. She shows up later, but she's not even taking part in the stories being told. It's about this king and this guy who loses his eyes to a god, and then you learn about the gods, and there's like this fool god, and then on top of that, you meet this other character who was born mute, and then a wizard gives him his voice back, and it's about, I don't know, it's like a fable within a fable, because then this character is telling Red Sonja the story, and then in the story, he tells a story about how he told these people another story so they wouldn't kill him. You know,
yeah.
I really love it when stories are being told in the stories themselves. And so it's ultimately a comic book about storytelling. Not that it's trying to do that necessarily, but you get that vibe from it. And they're like really clever little fable tales. And I'm actually quite amazed that Red Sonja does not kill anyone in this book, nor is she bent over or showing off her breasts anywhere in the book either. And she's really only in it for a couple pages. And yet it sustained me and it entertained me to no end. It was really good, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, that sounds cool. Red Sonja is kind of undergoing a really cool reinvention, reemergence.
Yeah.
And like a lot of artists that I really like or have been attached to those books. Bab Starr has been leaning hard into doing the covers. Christian Ward has as well. So I should definitely check it out.
Yeah, for sure. I think Mark Russell's writing most of it.
Oh, that's cool. Lately. I like one consistent narrative viewpoint, even if it goes across the art, right? It makes it feel kind of like legendary in a way that I think Red Sonja and those other fantasy books should be. That's the same way I feel about like Sword of Conan changing stuff up. So,
Right. So what is your number one pick?
My number one pick is Powers of Ten, number one, written by Jonathan Hickman with art by R.B. Silva. The fantastic cover was also done by R.B. Silva. This book is huge in scope. It's very, very dense. It almost seems like less things happen page per page or panel for panel than last week's House of X number one. But the impact of them and the intentionality of them is so much larger in scale, almost exponentially so. Like I mentioned before, the book is telling a story over 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years. So we're looking at this future of mankind in a really interesting way that I think imparts a lot of thematic direction that the book is intending to follow, as well as I think like the other Dawn of X stories out of this will follow. We outlined those last week. Hickman is just so incredible at world building. You've got like this incredible stuff, this almost really scary stuff actually, that happens with Mr. Sinister off panel, so you don't see it at all. Mr. Sinister is like breeding mutants in pits on Mars. And Nimrod the Lesser and Nimrod the Great, the Sentinel villain, although most senators are villains too. The Sentinel villain is there. He kind of undergoes a much more intentional characterization than I think he ever got in the Claremont stories. You've got a lot going on with like the future of the world and Eden, and there's definitely a through line for an exploration of Hebrewism and Zion and Israel and Judaism and other stuff like that. Like, it's really, really big, and I think that you could get almost anything out of it that you wanted to. But also that it's very apparent that Hickman has thought a lot about this story and tried to build in almost breadcrumbs to recontextualize what's happening in House of X, and then what's happening in Powers of Ten, and then back to House of X, and then forward to Powers of Ten, back and forth over the next, 10 weeks? It's very, very intentional, very, very cool to have House of X really, really reliant on characters that we know, like Magneto and Cyclops and Xavier and stuff, and then have Powers of Ten, which has a bunch of characters that we don't know at all, except from an opening scene of Moira MacTaggert and Charles Xavier. It's like the best culmination of saying, I'm going to show you the history of mutant kind and their future in a way that feels alien and foreign and weird to you, but also I intend to show you how we got there over time. It feels really, really natural and really cool and big and crazy to me. I'm kind of talking around it on purpose because I don't want to spoil it. I don't really want to spoil any of the individual things that happen in this issue at all, which I think is also a great sign of storytelling. And R.B. Silva's art is amazing, and it's got these like Destiny elements and these other weird sci-fi world building elements contrasted or juxtaposed against like nature and Eden and stuff like that, which House of X is really reliant on. So you have a kind of warm naturalistic story in House of X up against this cold, hard, almost dystopic sci-fi future in Powers of Ten, and the fact that these artists and Jonathan Hickman intend to reconcile that in some way is the most excited I've been about comics in at least 6 years.
When Silva draws Nimrod as a cute little character, I was like, this is an awesome book.
Yeah, it's really good.
There's like elements like that. You don't expect it in a big sci-fi doomsday storyline or whatever, you know? And then it almost brings it down a notch where it's like, oh, if Nimrod could do like a cute little thing, it makes it more realistic in a sense. I don't know.
No, why. I think it does. It grounds it really, really well when you're talking about things as big as I was outlining earlier. Hickman is touching on a ton of stuff that has been in X-Men stories in the past, like utopias and dystopian futures and Mr. Sinister and like a god figure. And the list just keeps going. There's like 30 tropes in this book, which kind of makes you feel like you're looking at like a Wikipedia page or an outline of a story. But then you have Hickman and R.B. Silva drawing and writing in those really small, earnest moments like Nimrod that I think ground it really well.
For sure. Yeah, it was a really, really entertaining book. It feels like Marvel really is resetting things and getting things, pushing things into new directions we've never seen before.
Oh, yeah. It feels like a complete and total paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm. You know what's not a paradigm shift? My number one pick, which is basically just a retelling of the Fantastic Four origin. Marvel is re-releasing a 2012 story in trade paperback called Fantastic Four, Fantastic Origins. And it's written by Robert Aguirre-Sacasa, and it's drawn by David Marquez. Roberto, you know, he's actually huge now. He's doing Riverdale and The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. But back in 2010-ish, he was all over Marvel. And I picked this because it's just a really good retelling. First of all, Marquez's art is out of this world, as we all know from the preview images for Batman Superman that are coming out. That book's coming out in 3 weeks, I think. But at the same time, Roberto has taken the Fantastic Four origin, added a couple things, removed a couple things, made it very clean, understandable, and highly enjoyable. One thing that he added that was kind of a shock to me is how Mole Man is directly connected to the Thing and his sort of journey from being this horrible monster to being okay with being a monster if it means he can help his first family. And there are some pop culture references in there, which I say in my review at aiptcomics.com. Like, they reference Mad Men and they reference J.J. Abrams as the monster director. And obviously those things don't hold up. And it's only been 7 years since this came out. But at the same time, I loved it. I gave it a 10 out of 10. And there are other single issues that I really like too. But I don't know. I just wanted to give this one a shout out because it's very much worth your time. If you've ever been a person who's like, Fantastic Four, they're not so great, pick this up and I guarantee it'll change your mind.
I will, because I don't care for them at all.
There you go. I'll send you the book. I don't know where it is. It's in this giant pile.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, those are our top books of last week. In our next segment, what do you know? Coincidence, I guess. We're going to be playing Cast This, where we cast a comic book that may or may not be turned into a movie. Although, I'm going to lean towards may be turned into a movie,
as Kevin
Feige basically said at Comic-Con this year. The mutants, he said, mutants, not X-Men, and the Fantastic Four are on the way at the Marvel Studios.
Coming to us sooner than later, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you think Fantastic Four? So we're going to cast Fantastic Four, if you couldn't catch my drift. But do you think it's going to come in Phase 4, or will it be more like Phase 5?
I almost want to say that there's going to be like a Phase 4.5, where they introduce like mutants and obviously the Fantastic Four, as Kevin has already said, in like Eternals or something. It's just like a springboard. Yeah. And then I think that they're gonna do some quieter, smaller individual stories that isn't a full phase. We'll see. I hope that they do some of it on Disney Plus as well.
Oh, that makes
that's
sense.
That's a great place to tell some of those stories.
For sure. Yeah. So for this segment, we usually go back and forth, right? And we'll pick each character.
Yeah.
Do you want to start with Mr. Fantastic?
Sure.
Who would you cast as Mr. Fantastic?
John Krasinski.
Okay. Yeah, I know why you picked this one. Go ahead.
Why? Oh, do you tell me?
Well, he was on Colbert. It was like a rumor a couple months ago, if not a year ago, that he and his wife would be Mr. Fantastic and Invisible Woman.
Oh, really? Emily Blunt? Oh, that's a good... Hold on, let me change my Invisible Woman cast here real quick.
But I tell me why you like him as Mr. Fantastic.
I think he is relatable and earnest, and I keep using that word, God. I think he's relatable, and you care about him, you know, as Jim. But I also think that he plays this smug, condescending asshole really, really well. I think he did so on The Office, and I definitely think he's done so in movies since. I also think he would look great with some gray in his hair.
So. Yeah, for sure. And we know that he can get pretty ripped,
and also
too,
he's so tall. He can
pull off that superhero body.
Yeah, he's tall and can get too. Ripped.
So my Mr. Fantastic would be Rami Malek, first and foremost,
Whoa.
Because he's an amazing actor.
Whoa.
I know, it's crazy. He doesn't have that build or body of like a superhero.
No,
but
I think he's like a foot tall.
Yeah, he's very tiny, apparently. I think he can play weird and also intense really, really
sure,
well.
Sure, Mr. Robot, yeah.
I feel like Mr. Fantastic is a character that's hard to pin down for your classic, you know, superstar actor because he needs to be kind of an asshole and selfish and also unaware of what he's saying that could potentially hurt someone's feelings. And I think Malek could pull that off.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I'm not mad at it. I think I could see
You're mad at me?
Rami playing a villain more than I could see him playing like a Mr. Fantastic that I could get engaged with or care about. But
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he got a Oscar for Queen, so he can do anything
right.
he wants, I guess, at this point.
True. If we follow the Blade rules, apparently you can just call Kevin and say, I want to make a movie.
Yeah, Kevin has a one Oscar rule where you cannot call him unless you won an Oscar if you're an actor.
Which one are we doing next?
Invisible Woman.
Invisible Woman. My Invisible Woman is Emily Blunt.
You son of a bitch. What was
it
before?
I switched it. I think Emily Blunt is a great idea. I think John Krasinski and her have obviously incredible chemistry. I love her in whatever the fuck that Tom Cruise movie is.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah, Live, Die, Repeat. Whatever it is.
Yep.
That man, she's awesome. She would be so great in an MCU movie. My original casting was Emma Stone.
Emma Stone. Yeah. Interesting. That could work.
I think she'd be okay as Invisible Woman. I also want to give her a chance to not play Gwen Stacy or not play Gwen Stacy in a very bad Spider-Man movie.
Yes.
So.
She needs superhero retribution.
Yeah. I'm trying to... I'm trying to pick characters that I think can be funny and serious. Because Fantastic Four is a good distillation of that. And I think especially so in the MCU.
Yeah, it's important. Especially for these big tentpole pictures. My Invisible Woman would be Erin Moriarty, who you may not know, but she's currently playing Starlight in The Boys.
Oh.
And yeah, she's really young. She's only like 23, but obviously she's blonde, so that's part of my decision making.
An important factor.
But she, in this series, in The Boys, she plays a character that she really does want to do good for the world, even though all the heroes around her are really messed up monsters. And I think she plays that young but also self-determined hero character really well. And I don't know, she kind of just looks like Invisible Woman, obviously. So that was why she's...
Yeah,
but she's also a fantastic actress.
You can't discredit
her. Her acting in The Boys is solid. Like, I think she could easily do a movie. Obviously, she's only done this TV show, but pretty much I think she's only done this TV show. But yeah, I think she could pull it off. Who's your Human Torch?
My Human Torch is John Boyega.
John Boyega?
Yep.
Remind me who that
Finn
is?
Finn from Star Wars?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yep. Yeah. Okay.
Again, someone that I think can be really serious but also really funny. I think he's got kind of the athleticism that the Human Torch character needs to have. I would love to see him with Tom Holland because obviously Johnny and Spider-Man have a long history of kind of like friendly rivalry, and I think John and Tom could nail that. I just really like John Boyega, and he actually has a very authentic American accent. For being a British actor. I think he's really great. I really liked him in that sci-fi movie as well. Attack the Block? Is that what it's called?
Yes.
He's so good in that. And I think that's more Human Torch than anything in Star Wars is, but I definitely like, yeah, dude, you can obviously handle being in a big movie, you can obviously handle a lot of weird costumes and like all sorts of VFX and stuff like that. So I think he's really just kind of been molded perfectly for this role.
You know, it's funny, I completely forgot the Spider-Man connection, and they're totally going to play into that.
Yeah.
As long as they continue to, you know, obviously have a relationship with Sony.
Yeah, I think that they will. I saw actually on Twitter the other day, just someone posted a thread of tons of different panels of either Johnny or Spider-Man coming in through each other's windows. And they're funny. Never use the door. I don't know who established this rule, but, and then that happens in Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man. So I thought that that was really funny.
Yeah, that was a good scene too. My pick is Dacre Montgomery, who plays Billy on Stranger Things, the bad guy in the last two seasons. I picked him. Again, he has the physique of a superhero, obviously. But also, Human Torch is kind of a dick, right?
He's
obviously always...
Yeah, absolutely.
He's razzing the thing. He has an ego problem. I could totally see Dacre pulling off this egomania issue. While also being heroic when he needs to be. Obviously, if you've seen Stranger Things, no spoilers. But he has the ability to rise up, I think, and prove that he is a good person at the end of the day, even though he's mostly a jerk all the time. Hmm. He's like the right age, I think, too. I mean, all of my picks are pretty much around where they need to be if they were to make this movie in the next 5 years, in my opinion. Who is your thing?
John Cena.
No. That's so funny. I picked a wrestler too. But he's in, how are they going to do that when he's invisible half the time?
You can't see me. Yeah, he should play Invisible Woman.
There you go. That would be oh my god, if he was the thing, he would totally do that joke.
Yeah, they totally would. 100%. Yeah. That's funny. Did you just look up buff actors, cuz that's what I did?
No, I was actually, I had just saw Hobbs and Shaw, so I picked The Rock for the thing. Now, I know that's hilarious in a sense.
I think it's funny that we picked really similar actors.
I mean, they're both funny, right? They both can act. They're both huge dudes, which I think is a key element for this character. But that's funny.
That's really funny. Yeah.
I think this would be a perfect entry for The Rock to enter the Marvel Universe.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's like, he looks like he's 30. He could play this role for 20
years.
I
guess The Rock has more acting chops than John Cena. And the thing needs to be a kind of like those drama masks where one is laughing and one is sad. I know there's a name for that, but I can't think of it right now. He could do that really well. I don't know that Cena could. Although John Cena was in an animated Scooby-Doo movie that's actually really funny and really good. So,
oh, nice. I had one other pick. I know we already did the four.
Hit
but
me.
After reading Fantastic Four, Fantastic Origins, I realized Mole Man being part of their origin is a really good idea. So I, for Mole Man, would love to have Jason Momoa as Mole Man. Now, hear me out. I know he's like 6'7 and built, and Mole Man is a 4 foot tall little loser guy.
Uh-huh.
But I think this is great casting because the character will slowly grow and become a hero in his own right. And science, hello, he could like get taller.
Hello, science. Have you heard of it?
Do you have a? I don't know if you had a pick for Mole Man or not.
I did. I cast Paul Giamatti.
Ooh, interesting. That's actually really good. That's way better. That's a good. I like that.
Short, kind of like grumpy.
Really
actor.
Good at being angry.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
For sure.
And also, I originally cast Paul Giamatti and Emma Stone because I was like, let's get him out of the Amazing Spider-Man movies. Let's give him another chance. The same way that they did with Michael B. Jordan for the original Fantastic Four movie. Or the not original, whatever the fuck that movie is. F4.
Oh, yes. By Josh Trank. What is his name?
I don't know, and I don't care.
I did not watch that movie.
It's really bad.
So that's the end of our segment, Cast This. I hope you liked our picks. If you don't, just let us know in the comments.
Hear me out real quick before you transition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Terry Crews as the thing.
See, like you just said, though, he needs to be kind of sad.
Can Crews absolutely pull off sad? There's some pretty serious episodes of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Yeah, I think, I love...
Apparently, as long as you're built like a brick house, you can play the
thing. That's the only thing that we're using as a qualifier. And then it falls apart as soon as we're like, can they be a serious actor also?
It's a tough one. Yeah. It's a tough one. All right, in our next segment, top books for next week, we're going to talk about the number one book we're looking forward to out next week. And I want to go first, please.
Fine.
Okay, fine. I'm going to pay for that later. So I picked Justice League number 29, written by Scott Snyder, James Tynion, and art by Bruno Redondo. I haven't picked Justice League for a while, not because the book's been bad by any means, but this is a Jaro-centric issue. And if you have been reading this series, Jaro is basically a little kid version of Starro and calls Batman dad, okay? So... Jaro takes over most of the issue, and spoilers, no spoilers. I've already read the issue, so I already know it's quite good. It's another issue where I cannot believe Tynion and Snyder have packed it so fully with content. It just feels like I'm getting two or three issues of content for the price of one. And
can I ask you a question? Because you use that as a compliment for the book often.
Yeah.
Does it ever get too weighty? I haven't read it.
That's the thing. So that's the thing.
Here's my fear, right? I don't read, obviously, as many DC comics. And whenever I try to start with a number one or get really into a series that people are really into, I'm like, holy shit, there's so much DC stuff I need to know to read this. Yeah. I tried to get into Young Justice, Brian Michael Bendis's new book, when it started at number one, because I love Bendis. I think he can write young characters really well. And I read the first issue and I was like, I don't know what half of this means. Does Justice League feel like that to you, or does it feel like more natural storytelling?
Definitely natural. They actually, it's funny you say that, because this issue does a lot of recapping of stuff that was in Metal and No Justice. What is that little miniseries? The 4-issue miniseries. They did No Justice, No... It's not No Peace. But they did a 4-issue arc a couple months ago. And it's recapping a lot of it, but it's also recontextualizing it to make it make more sense. Mm-hmm. Which this series tends to do every so often, which is really helpful. I definitely think you could pick this issue up and just read it for what it is. Now, when you're saying is it heavy handed? Like, is they dumping information?
Right.
On
you? Is it just like, oh God, I'm gonna have to keep track of all of that?
With this issue, the way they bring in the like really heavy handed world building stuff, they like start it off, then they cut to like a scene with characters fighting or talking. And then they go right back to where you left off with that narrative, those captions, kind of filling you in on the bigger picture stuff. And it flows really nicely.
Okay.
I don't know how. I was actually, it's funny you bring all this up, because I was reflecting on that before we recorded, because I was just reading it. Yeah, it's really good. And this was in, I can't remember anything today. What was the Drowned? The Drowned big event they did? That too had, it was really good at this, where you'd have characters fighting or talking, and then you'd get back to this like end in the beginning of time. Like in the beginning of this issue, they talk about a planet that is outside of the jar that is our universe. And you're basically getting a whole background on this planet and why it matters and why it's special. And then it kind of it gets brought into the bigger picture later on. Meanwhile, Jaro is in a Robin costume, pretending to be Robin and fighting the Lex Luthor and all the bad guys. It's hilarious.
Okay. Huh.
So the book is really good at like, here's this giant
balancing
idea.
Those things. Yeah.
Meanwhile, Jaro is saying ridiculous things and he's a freaking baby starfish.
Hmm. Okay. Okay. I'm always constantly looking for a good jumping on point, because I really like discrete stories from DC.
Yeah.
You know, I really love Court of Owls. I really love Batman Year One. I guess I really love a lot of Batman. But I also love, like, Superman Red Sun and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I just, like, have never found the thing that's, like, this is going to get me invested in the universe at large, which I feel about a lot of Marvel books. So
Justice League is definitely that book. I would totally agree with you. Like, Green Lantern, I mean, he's kind of doing his own thing in his own corner now with Grant Morrison behind it. And Bendis has kind of always been doing his own thing since he joined, doing his own corner with Superman and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard because DC definitely feels like continuity is a key, right? And you need to know what's going on elsewhere to really get the picture.
Yeah.
This book is really much, it's very much setting up Year of the Villains, like big thrust with their, you know, big event style storytelling. So it's definitely a jumping on point for that too.
Okay, cool.
What book are you looking forward to next
week? I am looking forward to Absolute Carnage number 1, written by Donny Cates with art by Ryan Stegman.
Huh, I would have never guessed it.
I feel that I don't even need to really talk about it.
Yeah, we already know. Yeah. We know you love Maximum Carnage. We know you love Donny Cates. Right. We know you love Venom. Right. What else is there we need to know? I mean, this is a 60-page issue,
I am really, really excited to see Stegman back on the book or doing the art. Mm,
it's been a while.
It's been a bit. It's been a bit, and I think it's because he's put so much time and effort into this. Mm-hmm. I'm really, really excited to see Venom become the straight-up-and-down horror sci-fi story that it has always been meant to be.
Do you know how long the series will be?
I 5 issues, I think. Oh, cool. But it has a lot of tie-ins as well. I hopefully will be reviewing them. So I'm very invested.
You've been talking about it for a while, so I'm excited to read your reviews.
I think, like, we'll see if it gets this kind of big, unwieldy event thing that seems to be happening with Marvel a lot. Like, I totally forgot Acts of Evil was going on, and then I saw, there's a Venom annual out this week, and I was like, what the fuck? And then hot off War of the Realms, right while the X-Men are relaunching and stuff, like, it's a publishing nightmare, but I also don't think that that means that the stories are bad themselves, so.
Right.
People that I would put on my short list to trust with the story are Donny Cates and Ryan Stegman, so.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. It is kind of crazy we're going into another event already.
Right.
But.
Right.
I guess one could say War of the Realms was like the big event and everything else has been smaller in a sense.
I'm excited about, I think that that's true. I definitely think did they already forget Acts of Evil? Did they forget to promote it? You know, it's just a series of annuals, I guess, but
yeah, it's not really connected, but then there was Age of X-Men.
Yeah. Right. There's a lot going on. And it definitely, I think, as a byproduct, makes Absolute Carnage feel smaller. And that kind of bums me out, actually. But the premise is that Carnage is hunting down every single person that's ever worn a symbiote. And, I mean, you're talking Captain Marvel, Captain America, every X-Man, pretty much. So I think, we're finally going to see how big the impact of Carnage and Venom's stories is on the Marvel Universe at large, which is something that I've always been invested in and cared about as an individual reader, but I don't think gets the proper due that it does. It's also going to finally cement Spider-Man as having the greatest rogues gallery of all time, so that's long overdue.
I wonder how much Null will play into it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's gonna be a springboard for a larger Null story, or if this is gonna kind of be the culmination of the Null thing. Null is obviously present over in Silver Surfer as well as Guardians of the Galaxy, so it's a big story that Donnie's telling across multiple books, but Absolute Carnage seems to kind of be at least a midway point for it. So
for sure. In our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, this is where we talk about cover art that we really, really like. And it mimics the weekly column, Judging by the Cover, which we have at AIPT every Monday. I'm actually taking part in Judging by the Cover this week. So I'm doing it double time. What is your favorite cover art?
My favorite cover art is Daredevil number 9. The cover art is by Julian Totino Tedesco. It's got Daredevil in his classic black uniform, like the ninja mask over his face, standing on top of a church or a pulpit. It's got this really cool, negative space rosary, just blank white dots across what is a very obviously painted background, creating this really cool negative effect. It's broken right at Daredevil's body. It breaks apart. And then it says, "No devils, only God, part 4, right below Daredevil. It's stacked. It's all stacked and vertical in a really, really satisfying sense. And the "No devils, only God, part 4 is in white text, except for where the cross of the rosary is crossing it. And that text is red. So it's really just picking up on every single important Daredevil motif in one image. It's really, really visually satisfying, well designed, using digital effects as well as painter effects really well. And the fact that it's on the cover of one of the greatest Daredevil stories ever told, what Chip is doing in that book right now. Like, yeah, it feels totally warranted. It feels really cool. It feels vital and necessary in a way that I think, like, people want Daredevil stories to be after what happened with the Netflix show.
Right. Nice. Yeah, it's really moody. I like it.
It's cool.
My favorite cover is House of X number 2 by Pepe Larraz. This is a cover that was kind of revealed months and months ago and now. It's got like a symmetry thing going on with all these triangles. If you go to amputeecomics.com, you can see it, actually.
Yeah, it's like a mandala a bit.
And in each triangle is a different character. And behind them, though, which really fascinates me, are the thumbprints, which give it this weird science-y feel. I mean, it just, the whole cover just feels like something out of Hickman's mind, right? It's just, it's got this graphic design element to it that you don't normally see on a cover. And it just draws you in. You're like, why are these characters all in this formation? Who's the girl in the middle?
Moira McTaggart.
Right. And it's all the same. It's just her from like different dimensions or something. Right. Yeah. I mean, different looks. It's the kind of cover where you can sit and just look at it and contemplate what's going on. Sort of like if you watch Lost and every week you were like, what is the smoke monster? I look at this cover and I'm going, what is this cover? What does it mean? Why does Magneto look so angry? And why is he paired with Nimrod and Apocalypse? Who knows? Find out next week at House of X number 2. And that's my favorite cover.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's one of those things that's like, this will be talked about for forever.
Right. Yeah. For sure. All right. That's the end of that segment. Next segment, Adaptation the Wrong Way. Wait, what? That's kind of a naming that we're working on. But basically, we want to talk about what movie would be good adapted into a comic book.
Yeah, I mean, they usually go the other way, right? Like, some of the biggest movies of the year or the past decade are comics movies, but there are definitely some great stories being told in movies that I would love to see in comics go the other way, the wrong way, so to put it.
What is your pick?
My pick is also a TV show, but it definitely has a movie, a much maligned, although I think recently appreciated movie, Twin Peaks.
Oh, yeah.
And if I could pick anyone, I would pick Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino so that they could just tell the story. Excuse me. So that they could just tell the story that they're telling in Gideon Falls, which is so obviously skirting around some Twin Peaks stuff in the sense that they actually want to, which is by using David Lynch's imagery and storytelling and all sorts of weird plot beats and meta-contextual, meta-narrative stuff. In a new medium, which I think would be really exciting.
Nice. Yeah, that would be an interesting comic. Definitely draw people in and like have them contemplating like what's going on.
Yeah, and like, you know, David Lynch, he actually thinks of himself as a painter first. I watched a really interesting documentary with him called The Life Story, where he talks about how every scene that he makes or the scripts that he writes, he's thinking about very distinct visuals or vignettes. And like, you go watch Blue Velvet and it's like, yeah, half of this is just referencing Americana or Renaissance art in its weird staging and giant red drapes and cloaks and all that shit. Like, and I think that his style in particular could be adapted to a comic really, really well. Also, just like put his paintings on the covers because that will get people talking.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There are probably some pretty twisted ones. So I want to pick. You ready for this?
Hit me.
The Tarantino universe because it's all combined. We know this.
Yeah. Okay.
I think Pulp Fiction, if we were to get a comic series, that would be really rad. And, you know, because he takes a lot of editing risks, it could be really cool in a visual comic style. And as far as artists, I think I would pick Mitch Gerads. I think with Sheriff of Babylon, he proved that he can do a really good job with non-superhero storytelling. Moody, gritty, dark when it needs to be. And yeah, let's just adapt all of his stuff. In fact, let's just make a universe inside the universe. We don't even need to directly adapt the movies. Let's just do like a Pulp Fiction sequel.
Stories from the Tarantino U.
Now get this. Tarantino has said he only has one more movie in him. And then from there, he's going to go and write plays. What about comics, Quentin?
Do you think that's really going to be Star Trek?
I doubt it. I mean, I don't know why people are asking about that. Because honestly, the script's already written. It's not like... Right? It's not like he's going to go and make it. He probably wouldn't direct it. He's never directed a movie like that. He'd probably just hand the script to someone like J.J. Abrams and he would, you know, he would direct
it. Yeah, okay. That it gives him plenty more time to do comics, like you're saying. Yeah.
I definitely think that Star Trek script will eventually come out if they never make it, though. It'll probably be leaked or whatever.
Sure. Like Hateful Eight was.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, that is the first time we ever had that segment. I think we could.
I think absolutely we should. Well, let us know, y'all.
You can get at us
on Twitter, or you can leave comments. Just let us know.
In our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, this is where we talk about something non-comic related, although we did talk a little bit about movies on this show today. But I think it's my turn. Was it my turn?
I don't know anymore.
I didn't actually ask you. So I'm going to go off and just tell you my Off Topic Top Shelf, which is...
Go off, Hunty. Slay.
The Boys. I really liked the show. I did not like the comic at all. But after being at San Diego Comic-Con and seeing an entire skyscraper with the Boys ad, it actually worked on me. But in the Gaslight District, where all the really good restaurants are, they also took over like 5 buildings worth and just painted the main villain onto the side. And it was wild. So I was like, wow, Amazon is really... They're going all in with this, so it's got to be pretty good. And, you know, I like the cast a lot. They got Bones in there. The actor who plays Bones, I mean. What's his name? Let me look it up here. Carl Urban.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant the David Boreanaz TV show. I was like, what?
Oh, no, no. I was talking Star Trek Bones. Yeah. Jack Quaid is kind of like the main character. He plays Huey. Anyway, you know, obviously this is like a darker tone superhero story. It's gory as hell. But at the same time, it's not gratuitous. It's not insulting to any particular person. It's really anti-corporation and anti-absolute power. As we learn in the series, like the Superman figure is kind of nuts. And that actor, let me look up his name really quick. His name is Anthony Starr. He is so good as Homelander. He basically goes from, he's like miserable. Like he just hates himself. He hates his life. Because of his own mental health issues, I'm sure. And then a film crew shows up and his frown turns upside down quickly. He's instantly on as Homelander, the Superman, super nice guy. And then we find out all these terrible things he's doing on the side. And basically, not to spoil too much, but his character was basically, he grew up in a lab and without parents. And you get to see what would happen to a Superman-like character who had no family. And there are a lot of really interesting themes, but ultimately really good acting, really good soundtrack. Like all the music is like really classic, cool punk music, or not all of it, but a lot of it. And I'm excited for season 2. I'm excited that they already approved for another season because it's quite a well done show. Huh,
interesting.
And I don't even think it's at all like the original. I think it is. I mean, I think there's main plots that are similar, but they've definitely, I mean, that The Boys is pretty old, the comic. Mm-hmm. They've definitely like grown it up a bit and gotten it ready for a more public or more widespread audience. Cause I don't think most would like the comic.
No, I am not a fan of the comic.
So yeah, that's
my pick.
Interesting.
Okay. I'll give it a shot because you're into it. I just want some hopeful, kind stories in the world. And it feels like people just like keep doubling down on this edgy, gritty darkness thing. And I'm like, that's what my real life is like. You know, not to speak ill of The Boys, which I haven't seen. I've read, but I haven't seen. I'll give it a shot. I hope it's, you know, at least funny, which it seems to be. So
it is funny. It is. And, you know, I said this earlier, but Erin Moriarty, who plays Starlight, she is like that hopeful. She is the positivity of what superheroes could be in this world, in this The Boys world. So like, and she is like kind of one of the main characters. Obviously, though, you're right. Like, there very much is like corporations are ruining everything.
Which is, it's like,
kind of
yeah,
thing
I
going
know.
On.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think I will check it out based on your recommendation alone, which is kind of what this segment's all about.
Elizabeth Shue's in it too. She's super good. Also, you know, fun fact, I had a huge crush on her when I was in middle school. And it's only 8 episodes, so you can get through it pretty quickly too.
Okay. Yeah. I'll check it out.
Well, if you're still listening, you've checked out this whole episode. So thank you. Thank you for still being here and listening to us. If you liked the show, please like it. Please review it on Apple. And please subscribe.
Yes, please do. Also, last month was Spider Month, Spectacular Spider Month on AIPTComics.com, as you no doubt know if you follow our Twitter or have listened to the show. That has since wrapped up. I'm super thankful to all of our collaborators and contributors, talking people from the DC Super Sons podcast, Comic Book Couples Counseling podcast, interviews with Tom Taylor, Juan Cabal, Jed Mackey, number of other people. And so that
Dennis Hopeless, Dennis, Hallam,
the previous episode. So if you want to check that out, yeah. Number of people contributed. I'm immensely thankful for that. And also, you can go check out an entire month's worth of original content on aaptcomics.com.
Yeah, great work. Thank on that you. Spider-Man month, or Spider month. I always say Spider-Man month. Damn it. Yeah. No, you did a great job. And there's a lot of really interesting content in there, especially if you like deep cut interviews and just really well thought out features.
Yeah, thank you. I hope people will check it out, because it's all available now.
Available at a internet near you.
Call 1-800-AIPTComicsPodcast.com.
If you order in the next 5 minutes, you get 2 more podcasts.
And I will say thank you to you personally.
Who, me?
Who are our callers.
Oh, shoot.
But also thank you.
No, you know, it wasn't for me.
This is,
take it
this
back.
It's going too long. We got to bail. We got to get out of here. Bye, thanks. Y'all.